Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a conversation with the editor of the Cult of Mac blog. Thousands now have their iPhones, but can they turn them on? But first, there is a new report that police may have been closing in on an alleged terror plot in Scotland just hours before the attack at Glasgow Airport. Also, two new suspects are in British custody today as the manhunt continues in connection with the alleged Al-Qaeda plot at both the airport and in London, where two car bombs failed to detonate on Friday. Among the suspects, two men believed to be physicians, one in Scotland, one at a hospital outside London. There are now several suspects in custody. Newsweek's Emily Van Catt is covering the story from London. And Emily, it's one that's developing very quickly. Could you just comment on that? Because we understand that this is the buzz in Britain of how quickly this is going.
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, the fact that the investigation is developing so quickly is throwing up more questions than answers. I mean, what we have so far is reports across very reputable news sources that are contradicting each other on a regular basis. And there are a lot of names that have been put forward and are being bandied about. But the police have still yet to confirm even one name of anyone arrested.
We know for this reason Newsweek is not reporting right now any names.
That's the one name that that we've gotten independent confirmation of is Mohammed Asha, who is a medical physician. He's thought to be Jordanian and a relatively young man in his mid-20s.
And is he the gentleman who is being treated in a hospital because of burns sustained in the Jeep attack at Glasgow, or is he the second alleged physician who's in custody?
He is the second alleged physician. Mm-hmm. He is. It is not understood that he's one of the ones being treated for burns up in Scotland.
Well, we know that this is moving quickly. So just we're getting different reports here as well. We had a report today of a bomb unit rushing to the hospital in Scotland where the burn victim is being treated. The burn suspect is being treated. Do you know any more about that report?
No, not yet.
Okay. We're also reading reports that police contacted a Glasgow area apartment rental agent. He said that the police contacted him about 10 minutes before the attack there, saying that a phone number dialed from an apartment that company leased had been traced to the London car bomb suspects. The Associated Press is reporting this. This would make a link between the Glasgow attack and the London attack. Do you know about any more links? Are there any more reports of possible links between the attacks?
The one thing that that police contacts are telling me is that it's likely that the London planned attacks are linked to the Scottish attack, and the reason for that is that the bombs in the cars were simply so similar. They were all filled with petrol, gas cylinders, and nails, and I guess the devices underlying that were similar enough to lead the police to the direction of thinking that they are. There is some underlying mastermind that links them up.
And what about the timing? I mean, much is being made of the London transit bombings of 2005 being on July 7th. There's a lot going on in the region. There was the big concert for Princess Diana. The late Princess Diana Wimbledon is still being played. So is there a sense of timing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one hallmark of Islamic fundamentalist attacks, particularly over the last couple of years in Europe, that we've seen is that they're always linked to big political events. So the July 7th attacks took place during the G8 summit, one day after London won the Olympics. In 2004, the Madrid bombings took place in the run-up to their national elections. And, of course, the most obvious link right now, I think, and what most people here are linking it to, is Gordon Brown having taken over as Prime Minister just last Wednesday.
Right. And just a quick question on the mood. How are people in the region going about, and how do they feel that Prime Minister Gordon Brown is doing?
People are very much going about their daily business as usual. I mean, it's in a lot of ways, Britain has been under attack for many, many years, first by the IRA and now, obviously, with Islamic fundamentalists. And so there's a strong sense of everyone going about their daily business and that making that making them win their personal war on terror.
Yeah. Emily Van Catt, Newsweek correspondent based in London. Emily, thanks so much for catching us up.
Thank you.
Well, we have a change of pace now to ask the question, how's your iPhone working? According to New York's Newsday, this weekend, Apple sold more than 500,000 iPhones. That's the device that's a phone, it's the internet, it's your new iPod, and it can also play movies. Hundreds of thousands of people lined up to pay from $500 to $600 for one, including the mayor of Philadelphia, who reportedly staked out a spot online and waited off and on for 15 hours, even as passersby asked, don't you have something better to do? The iPhone is winning raves from critics. Dazzling, beautiful, elegant, some of the words they use. But those are the people who can turn it on. AT&T is exclusive carrier of the iPhone, and they say most customers were able to activate their phones within minutes, but others can't. And at least one business writer is also asking, hey, what's with the battery? So there's been some criticism as well. Today, how's the iPhone doing? And also, who are these people standing online? A customer base so loyal that it's taken on religious overtones, with the faithful making pilgrimages to the company's San Francisco campus. They call the iPhone the Jesus phone. Wired News managing editor Leander Caney has written two books about Apple, and he also writes the Cult of Mac blog. It's named after the Apple's popular personal computer for Wired magazine. He joins us now. Leander, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, do you have your iPhone?
I do. I bought one on Friday.
Well, how do you feel about it?
I am absolutely blown away. I think it's fantastic.
How do the movies look on it?
The movies look fantastic. If you put high-definition content on it, it's better than a high-definition TV.
We hear there's some criticism about the way you use it, that there's both a keypad, and tell me about its usability as a phone.
I think its usability is pretty good. People are complaining that you don't have speed dial. You can't assign, say, the number one button to call your wife or husband. And on the iPhone, you have to click it on, you have to unlock it with your finger, then you have to go to the phone menu and then click favorites and then choose who you want to phone. So it's probably a four-step process.
Why wouldn't they do that?
Because there's no easy way to, there's no buttons to assign to do things.
Maybe it's because all of the buttons and doodads are taken up by all the other things that the device does.
There may be an easier way to do it. I think, probably the first screen that comes up should probably be the phone screen, and maybe you could have these virtual speed dial buttons that you would hit.
But other than that, how do you, I mean, why else do you like it?
Oh, because it's such a, it's a little handheld computer that makes mobile email and web surfing, a really nice experience, when it used to be a horrible experience. If you've ever tried to get the web on your cell phone or try to send an email, it's a nightmare. And then this weekend, I gave it to my kids, my 10-year-old, and she was sending email immediately and was having great fun doing it.
What was the problem with the startup? Let's just go over some of these things. Some say it's because the phones aren't activated in the store where you buy them, like other cell phones. That was part of the problem. How are they activated, and what's the problem?
You actually took the iPod home, and when you plugged it in, you activated it through iTunes. And it was a quick sort of five-click process. It would step you through, asking if you wanted to get a new number or transfer your current number, and then it would take your credit card details and set you up with a new account. It seems that some people had problems with this.
I'm imagining if there were 500,000 sold and if everyone tried to do it at the same time, that would be a problem.
Yeah, I think that's a major infrastructure stress test. They probably were having, I'm surprised that there weren't more problems.
Well, but some are saying one of the biggest problems is that the company teamed up with AT&T because its data network is supposed to be painfully slow. So why would a company that is known for excellence, doing everything better than anyone else, why team up with AT&T?
Because it's the biggest wireless provider, and I think they were looking to get the most coverage. I think if they teamed up with one of the smaller companies, then they would have had different problems with customers complaining that they couldn't get service. So I think they simply went with the largest provider they could get.
Well, Joe Nocera writes about this in the New York Times this past weekend, and his guess is that it has something to do with how slow AT&T is. He says that one theory out there is that AT&T would put less drain on the batteries of the iPhones. Now, let's just talk briefly about the batteries themselves, because this is something that he also writes about and that people are really buzzing about today, that much like the iPod, with your iPhone, the battery is not detachable. You actually have to send them back when the battery runs out?
Yeah, in fact, it's soldered inside the device, so there's absolutely no way that the user can get in there and replace it themselves.
Well, as Joe Nocera writes, this stopped him in his tracks. You know,
well, people are unused to that, but it makes for a very seamless device. The battery life is really pretty good, and Apple is betting that, you know, people won't have a problem with the battery, with either recharging it or having to replace it at some point in the future.
Well, but as Nocera and others have said, it could be that, or could it be some sort of evil plot, some sort of planned obsolescence to force people to buy new product. For instance, if you bought your iPod a couple of years ago, if the battery's running out right around now, you're not going to give up your iPod. You're perhaps going to say, well, maybe I'll just buy the iPhone. Same with the iPhone. If it runs out in a couple of years, there will be a new piece of technology for you to buy rather than give up the thing that you've, you know, come to depend on.
Absolutely. There's definitely an element of that, that Apple is, I think, correctly guessing that most people will, in 2 years, be looking to buy a new iPod or iPhone rather than replacing the one they currently have. But, you know, Apple offers, I think it's $50. You can send your iPod into them, and they will replace the battery for you.
So you have you have to pay?
You do, but you probably would have to pay. You'd have to buy a new battery anyway. These things, they don't last forever. They only have a shelf life of a couple of years. And, yeah, Apple's made it not the easiest thing to do for you to get in and do it yourself. It's not like you can pop it out like a regular cell phone battery.
No, you're hardly going to give up something you've come to depend on so much. And this is why people view Apple as sort of, you know, they liken it to, well, an addiction that people have with their products. And the other criticism is that Steve Jobs, he likes closed systems.
Exactly.
Tell me more about
that. Why. I think he doesn't want the customer to be messing with the innards of the device. He doesn't want them to be bothered with having to change the battery. For him, that's sort of something a hobbyist, an electrics tinkerer does, not somebody who, you know, not the ordinary user. And so, you know, he's making a design decision on the customer's behalf. And, of course, some people, this bends them out of shape. But I think for most consumers, it's not that much of an issue.
It leads to the other criticism that he does that with all of his products and that you have to go purely his company product. You can't interact with any other company.
Right. And I think it's actually been, you know, with the iPod, a very successful strategy. The reason the iPod was so successful is because it was so tightly integrated with the software and with the online store. And they had none of the headaches that, you know, Microsoft's products had. They were very reliable, and they were very easy to use. Microsoft's Place Assure devices, all the competing MP3 players, were a real nightmare because, you know, they didn't have someone like Steve Jobs taking control of the whole experience, tying it closer to the software and the online stores. So, yeah, some people complain that this is a form of lock-in, that he's a control freak. But from his point of view, and from some of the customers' point of view, it's this ability to control all of the aspects that make it such a seamless experience.
One analyst told Joe Nocera, the iPhones and presumably other Apple products are designed with consumer sacrifice problems, but thousands of consumers are very willing to make that sacrifice for Steve Jobs, for Apple products. Leander Caney, managing editor at Wired News. When we come back, the cult of Mac. People so in love with their Mac computers that they keep them, for instance, as a litter box. Later today in Massachusetts, you have just 6 months from today to sign up for health care or what? We'll find out what will happen. That's all after the break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Leander Caney, author of the books Cult of Mac and The Cult of iPod. He also writes the Cult of Mac blog for Wired magazine. Apple, headed by Steve Jobs, had a good weekend. Critics asked who's going to want a $600 phone. Well, over 500,000 iPhones were sold nationwide. The iPhone, of course, also accesses the Internet. They play movies and music. Steve Jobs famously co-founded the Apple company in a garage. He presented the Mac computer, then was famously ousted while away. He headed Pixar, the animated film company. Then he came back to Apple and with the iPod, iTunes, and now iPhone made the company a Standard & Poor's powerhouse and the third largest music retailer in the U.S. behind Walmart and Best Buy. So, Leander, is Steve Jobs Apple computer?
Oh, he's absolutely the embodiment of the company. And, you know, quite remarkably, he's able to impose his considerable will on this huge corporation. he takes part in almost every major decision in the design process, right down to the tiniest details. You know, he'll complain that there's four screws inside, you know, bolting the motherboard, the battery to the motherboard, and it'll be too many for him. So he's completely and utterly in charge there.
And by the way, for the uninitiated, Apple built its following on the Mac. It's a stylish personal computer. Explain for those who aren't, again, the initiated, what makes a Mac different from other computers?
The tight integration of the hardware and the software. Apple has looked at all aspects of the sort of user experience and tried to streamline it as much as possible. It's designed from a sort of user's perspective. There's a huge focus at Apple on the customer and the customer experience, and they try to streamline that as much as possible. And they perfected this with the Mac, with the software that went on it. And this, I think, is, you know, they're applying it now to these gadgets. So you see the same thing in the iPod and now in the iPhone.
Is it too simplistic to say that it's for, you know, people who are more creative than, let's say, just people who are doing spreadsheets?
Well, that was, you know, a legacy of what kept the Mac alive. You know, it became very popular in desktop publishing and graphic design departments. And so the publishing industry picked it up. And, of course, it went through a very bad patch in the mid and late 90s. But, of course, you know, since the iPod, it's taken on a much broader user base, and I think you see it going back now much more to a general slice of the public.
And Steve Jobs worked very hard to create a rivalry with Microsoft, and he's also said that you need an enemy, someone to be compared to make people feel that they are special and not of the other group. So obviously that was by design.
Yeah, it's a very conscious marketing strategy. I think you define yourself by saying what you're not. You know, Coke and Pepsi, Nike and Puma, Microsoft and Apple. You could point to Microsoft and say, look, you know, we don't do things their way. You know, we're not a monopoly. We don't put out shoddy products.
You write a lot about Apple fans. What are some of the things that they do?
Well, you saw this weekend with the people camping out for the iPhone. Before this, people used to camp out regularly for the grand openings of Apple stores, and some people would fly international to go to Tokyo or to London to camp out for a couple of days. To get in, to be the first person inside those stores when they open them up. Of course, you know, people dress up as iPods for Halloween. People get Apple or Mac tattoos, Mac haircuts. The Macworld convention is a big gathering of the tribe.
They make pilgrimages as well to the
yeah.
Company. Tell us about that.
Well, people will take their vacation to come to Macworld, and then because it's in San Francisco and Apple's HQ is just down the peninsula in Cupertino.
But they can't get into the headquarters.
No, but there's a company store where you can go and buy branded T-shirts and mugs. So they'll rent a bus, and then a big group will go down, and then everyone poses for the same photograph where they genuflect in front of the Apple sign at the front, and they get to take pictures of the building, and they try to take pictures of people coming in and out, hoping to catch a glimpse of Steve Jobs, and then go spend a few dollars inside the company store and get a T-shirt.
A few hundreds of dollars on mouse pads. And the T-shirt says what in some cases?
I got one that says, I visited the mothership.
Which is the story there. We understand, too, they don't want to get rid of their used Macs. They what do? Turn them into fish tanks?
Right, that was the famous one, yeah. Taking those old all-in-one is pretty easily converted to a fish tank. And it's like, you know, getting a favorite pet stuffed or freeze-dried. It keeps it around and gives it a second life.
I'm trying to picture that. And I'm also trying to picture the litter box. That actually is easier to picture, that one could be turned into a litter box.
Well, people have turned them into mailboxes, and I've got some pictures of a guy that turned one into a bicycle helmet.
But again, why? We hear the products are great, but are they that great? Or is this marketing? Is this marketing?
It's a complex phenomenon. I think it's a bit of marketing, yeah. Apple's brand sort of speaks to people's aspirations. You know, it says that I'm creative and I'm free-thinking. And I think people, you know, they like to show it off, the same as they like to wear a certain brand of sneakers or drive a certain car. The choices you make as a consumer, you know, broadcast a lot about you as a person. And I think the computer, you know, it's a very personal device. You can use it for creativity and for communication. People have a very strong bond to it, and Apple's computers are made with more care than others, and so you see this kind of attachment.
Do you have a sense of what's next? Because many have said that, you know, how far can Steve Jobs go before he may have to step aside, as Bill Gates did, for instance, to become a philanthropist, because you have to keep coming up with the next big thing. I mean, especially, you know, as the batteries run out on these iPhones, I mean, the followers have come to expect the next big thing. Do you have a sense of what it is, or will he have to ultimately move over?
I don't know. It looks as though it's, you know, he's looking his age these days. He was kind of like a Peter Pan figure. He looked very young and handsome, and now he looks, you know, like a man in his middle ages, you know, 51-year-old. So
many would say, what's wrong with that? It's not exactly,
exactly.
Elderly.
You have to, you know, he had cancer scare a couple of years ago, and he was looking fairly thin last year, although he seems to have filled out now. Yeah, some wonder whether all of this work that he was doing was taking a toll on his health. The iPhone, I think, has become like the iPod. You'll see a whole new range of devices for every pocketbook, so there'll be some very cheap ones and there'll be some quite expensive ones. And then I think this finger technology is definitely the new way to control computing device.
You just put your finger on the face of something and move an item around as opposed to, what, clicking on something?
Yeah, with a mouse, yeah. And the interfaces are very clever. They haven't recreated the computer with the menus and the windows. They've taken a completely sort of a different design approach to it. So it's much easier to do. Very big buttons. They're very easy to hit. It has a whole range of applications. So you might see this on all kinds of different devices. The next iPod, I think, is definitely going to be like this. It'll be finger control. It won't have the scroll wheel. You'll do it with your finger.
Leander Caney, Wired News Managing Editor. His Wired blog is called Cult of Mac. Leander, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay. Still ahead, would you want to know if you had a genetic defect that might cause disease? That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. In a moment, the new law here in Massachusetts that mandates that everyone have health insurance. Is it coming to your state? But first, a look at the growing debate over personalized medicine, having your genes tested to see if you've inherited a tendency to, say, have heart disease or cancer later in your life. Would you want that information? And what would you do with it? And even if your insurance company pays for the tests, would you want them to know the results? If you get a positive result, you might lose your coverage. Here now is Alan Cockle has this report.
July 26, 2006, Holbrook, Massachusetts, a hot day. Carol Papura is at work.
I can't say I felt any different than any other day.
She's 58 years old, completely healthy as far as she knows.
I got up, left the office, turned around to put the key in the door, and when I turned back around, I had complete double vision.
Within minutes, her words start to slur. She gets weak on her left side. Carol phones her daughter, who phones their friend Kate, a nurse who calls Carol.
She said, Mrs. P, I want you to call 911. She says, I'm telling you right now, you are either having a silent heart attack or you're having a stroke, and I think it's a stroke.
More than 500,000 Americans fall victim to strokes every year. Carol Papura is one of the lucky ones. Rapid medical treatment helps break up the clot that's been obstructing blood flow to her brain. By the time she leaves hospital, her paralysis is gone. She's left with weakness, fatigue, and memory loss. But her doctor says there's one more thing.
He said, but you can't walk around like you are, because yes, you will have another stroke. And I looked right at him and I said, Coumadin, right? He goes, right.
Coumadin is a blood thinner, an anticoagulant, also known by the generic name warfarin. The drug has been around for 50 years. Carol's mother had taken the drug for decades, often experiencing serious internal bleeding.
There was one time that my mother lost 18 pints of blood. This woman threw up nothing. It looked like coffee grounds coming out of her mouth.
Warfarin reduces the risk of certain kinds of strokes, but Carol wanted nothing to do with it.
I said, you know, I lived with a mom that took 12 and 14 milligrams of Coumadin every night. And I said, you know what, after 10 years on Coumadin, I don't want to be in here bleeding out.
Believe it or not, we don't have a good system for dosing warfarin.
Dr. Sam Goldhaber at Brigham and Women's Hospital is Carol's cardiologist. He also cared for Carol's mother. Goldhaber says getting the right dose of warfarin is crucial. Too much causes bleeds. Too little puts patients at risk for another stroke. Yet for decades, the only way to start someone on warfarin has been to guess at the dose. So Goldhaber invited Carol to be part of a new study, an attempt to dose the drug based on an individual patient's genetic profile.
We signed her up that very day, and we drew an extra tube of blood and sent it to the genetics laboratory for rapid turnaround genetic testing.
Goldhaber is looking at two of Carol's genes. One controls how fast her body gets rid of warfarin. There are six versions of this gene. The other gene comes in three versions and predicts how sensitive the blood clotting system will be to the drug. Goldhaber hopes that knowing this genetic profile will help him to get the dose right the first time. If it works, the testing will more than pay for itself by preventing dangerous and costly complications.
Whenever people think about, you know, diagnostics, they talk about, you know, the amount of money that it's going to cost.
Raju Kuchalapati directs the Harvard Partner Center for Genetics and Genomics.
You remember that, you know, the first, you know, human genome sequence, you know, costs us $2 billion. And it is anticipated that by the year 2015, that we'd be able to sequence the entire human genome for $1,000.
There are already more than a dozen genetic tests used to guide drug therapy. Many predict the success or toxicity of cancer treatment. Kuchalapati believes the testing will soon spread to other new and individualized therapies for a broader range of diseases.
If, for example, a drug is effective only in 5% of the overall population, that drug is not going to be approved. But if you could show that that drug is effective in a subpopulation, the drug would be approved.
This vision of the future assumes that patients will be willing to undergo genetic testing. Francis Collins, the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, is one of many people who worry about the social barriers to personalized medicine. Collins says that one current problem is that genetic tests are subject to little regulation. The FDA oversees tests sold as a kit, but not the hundreds of so-called homebrew tests offered by independent laboratories around the country.
If this is our future, do we want it to get underway in this kind of fashion where the general public impression will be it's all snake oil? Because right now it's kind of is.
To summarize other risks, Colin sometimes likes to describe a set of scenarios he calls the two Bettys.
Uncle Bobby was 46.
Both scenarios begin 10 years from now when Betty is 21 years old. Two of her uncles died of early heart disease.
Uncle Bobby was 46 and Uncle Joey was 49.
So her doctor suggests that she have her genome sequenced to look for disease genes.
Could it affect my insurance?
In this first scenario, Betty's assured that genetic discrimination has been outlawed. Congress is considering such legislation right now. In this version of the future, Betty's family doctor has been educated about the test and is reimbursed for ordering it.
Okay, let's get it done.
It turns out that Betty has three gene variants that put her at risk for heart disease. Her doctor helps her adapt her lifestyle to reduce that risk.
I watch what I eat, I know, and I'm exercising.
When, at age 75, Betty develops a sore shoulder, she thinks she's pulled a muscle.
It's sort of a dull ache, but, you know, it could just be from gardening.
But her doctor knows her genetic profile and suspects a heart attack. Betty gets good medical treatment and lives to a ripe old age. In the second Betty scenario, the genetic discrimination ban has not passed and Betty refuses to get tested.
My brother lost his insurance because of one of those tests.
Her doctor doesn't know much about genetics and anyway, insurance won't reimburse him for ordering the test, so he doesn't push the issue. Betty never learns about her genetic risks and never makes lifestyle changes that would reduce her risk of heart disease.
Cheeseburger, large fries, and extra large Coke, please.
Betty is only 50 when her shoulder starts to hurt.
It could just be from gardening.
With no reason to suspect heart attack, her doctor prescribes a painkiller and sends her home. Betty returns to the emergency room a few hours later and dies of a heart attack. Personalized medicine is a dividend of the Human Genome Project, but Francis Collins, who led that project, stresses that genes alone do not seal our destiny. Collins advocates another immense study, perhaps 500,000 people followed over 10 or 15 years, all aimed at understanding how our genes interact with the environment.
A big project, a project which will be expensive in the way that the Genome Project was, but one that will basically change everything in terms of our understanding about what causes illness and what should we do about it.
Only this way, Collins says, will personalized medicine really reach its full potential.
Our report on personalized medicine was produced by Alan Cockle. Still to come before we go today, singer and fiddler Alison Krauss moves beyond the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, but not too far from the melancholy roots music she loves. You're listening to Here and Now.
Don't you cry.
We're feeling under intense scrutiny today here in Massachusetts. Yesterday, Massachusetts became the first state in the nation with a law requiring all residents to sign up for health insurance. And with nearly 45 million uninsured nationwide, other states are watching closely. The Massachusetts plan offers free or subsidized insurance for low-income residents. It also includes penalties for businesses that don't offer insurance to employees, as well as penalties for individuals who don't sign up. Joining us with more Here and Now is Martha Biebinger. Martha, before the law passed, about 500,000 people were uninsured in Massachusetts. Do we know how many have signed up, you know, for the start today?
Yes, Robin, about 130,000 people have insurance today who didn't have it a year ago. Mm-hmm. They are largely covered, though, through either free care through the state or subsidized insurance. The enrollment numbers so far for people who have to buy it on their own are pretty low, although we will get some more information about those people who have to buy coverage without state assistance at a meeting later this month.
Right, and as the grace period goes on, I'd assume. Right.
Yeah, the grace period goes on through December, so the state is really anticipating a fairly slow ramp-up.
Well, first of all, what sorts of options do people have? How much is it going to cost?
Robin, people in Massachusetts who earn up to $15,000 a year will have access to free health insurance. If they earn up to $30,000, they will be offered subsidies to help pay for their premiums. People between $30,000 a year and $50,000 a year will be encouraged to buy health insurance, but they probably won't face a penalty for not having it because the state understands that coverage may not be affordable for that group. Mm-hmm. Everyone at $50,000 or more a year will pay somewhere between $100 a month and $800 a month. $100 for the very youngest and $800 for people who are in their 50s and 60s. The state has tried to keep those premiums at between about 5 and 8% of their income.
And so some people are saying that it's pretty steep for them. But what are the penalties if they don't pay?
If they don't pay in the first year, it will cost an individual $219, and that's the loss of their personal exemption on the state income tax form. After that, though, the penalty goes up significantly. It will cost the individual half of whatever the cheapest plan on the market is. And that could be well over $1,000.
And the penalties for employers?
Employers could be penalized in two ways. First, if they don't offer insurance at all, they could pay $295 per employee. And the second way they could be penalized is that if they don't now offer employees the opportunity to buy insurance using pre-tax dollars, you and I pay our health care pre-tax, then they could be fined if their employees use free health care in the state.
Well, and I'm thinking you mentioned the individual penalty could be losing the $219 state tax exemption. There may be some people who might say, you know what, I'll do that for a year and then buy it a year from now.
Absolutely, Robin. There are a lot of people, I think, who are saying, why don't I just wait and see? Is the law going to be challenged in court? Are there going to be adjustments made? Are they going to change the premium levels? The enrollment for people who have to buy it on their own has been quite slow. There are people, as you said, who are talking about paying the penalty and avoiding a decision about whether to buy insurance initially. And there's also then just a lot of anger from people who don't feel that the state should be telling them what to do.
Well, and what happens if they don't sign up? We're hearing, in particular, if young and healthy people don't sign up, then the plan could be in trouble because they're the ones who subsidize it for people who might have more illnesses.
Exactly. So there's two things that need to happen in order for this law to work, or probably three. But one of them is that you need the young, healthy people to join so that they spread the risk of covering medical costs for the sicker people. You need everyone to sign up because part of this law depends on moving a pool of money, a big pool of money, close to $1 billion, from taking care of people for free at hospitals to insuring people. So the state needs people to stop using the free care pool and start being insured. And then the third thing is the state has to figure out a way to hold down the cost of health care, because if the cost of premiums keep rising, this plan just becomes more unaffordable for both the state and individuals.
And so we mentioned this is being watched at the national level. How so?
At least a dozen, two dozen states around the country who are doing some form of incremental health care. The plan that's closest to the one in Massachusetts is in California, where Governor Schwarzenegger wants the individual mandate, the requirement that everyone have health insurance. And leaders in the assembly there are less interested in going that far. They want to make a voluntary approach to covering the uninsured. But then you're also having candidates on the field, mostly the Democrats, who are talking about ways to expand coverage for the uninsured. And of course, this plan started with Governor Mitt Romney, who's now running for president.
Here now is Martha Biebinger on the new mandatory health care law that went into effect yesterday here in Massachusetts. Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Up next, she's got more Grammys than any other female artist, but Alison Krauss is still down home as they come. She's after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way.
Alison Krauss on the 2000 soundtrack for O Brother, Where Art Thou? By then, she'd already won an armful of her astounding 20 Grammy Awards to date. She'd had her own band at 10, was signed to Rounder Records at 13, was the youngest cast member of the Grand Ole Opry at age 21. She's credited with bringing roots and bluegrass music into mainstream pop and adult contemporary charts. She's known for covering a wide range of artists, from the Beatles to Bad Company, and for liking the band Foreigner, AC/DC, and Disney.
Rest your head close to my heart, never to part, baby of mine.
Alison's cover of the lullaby from Dumbo graces her new CD. It's called 100 Miles or More, and she joins us now on the line from Nashville, where she's on tour with Union Station featuring Jerry Douglas. And we really appreciate your time, Alison. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Dumbo. You know, when I heard that on the CD, I started welling up.
Yes.
Do you, and of course, Baby Mine is the song we're talking about. Do you remember, you know, watching that movie as a child? Do you remember that?
I do remember that. And my mother took me to see Dumbo, and that was the song that wore her out.
Yeah.
I remember calling my mother and I said, hey, I just got this call about singing your song from Dumbo. She's like, no way.
But how, as you said, it wore your mother out. I mean, it almost killed me and I was five, you know. How do you sing, you know, there's that song and then there's another one, Jacob's Dream, on the CD, which is a song written by Julie Lee and John Pennell that apparently had something to do with an ancestor of Julie Lee's, where two little boys get lost in the woods and...
Yeah, you know, it wasn't her ancestor. It's a really famous story where she grew up.
Ah.
How people know that story is the tragedy at Nob Hill.
Ah.
And it's about these two little boys. Their last name was Cox. And they, you know, follow their dad out hunting while the mother was doing chores. She didn't see them leave, and they got lost in the woods. And by the end of the story, 1,000 men had, you know, tried to find these two little boys, and the way they ended up being found was a man miles away had had a dream about the boys and where they were found, and had the dream for 3 nights, and the wife encouraged him to share his dream, and then they found the boys, of course, cold and still.
Oh, man.
But it's a true story, and I've never had a tune affect me like that one has. And for me, the most tragic part in the song itself is how they portrayed the little boys crying for help and crying for their parents and wondering why they wouldn't come.
For two more nights, the dream returned, this vision sent from God. You hear our cries, the day is almost over, soon it will be night. We're so cold and hungry, and our feet are tired and sore. We promise not to stray again from our cabin door.
How do you sing that?
Awful. Yeah, it was really tough. I had a hard time getting through it, and you know, just have to keep singing it over and over to kind of not harden yourself, but know the story well enough where it doesn't surprise you every time it comes around.
Well, and you know, that's a story, just a horrible story of the most unimaginable loss. But even when it's just another of my favorites is the first cut, You're Just a Country Boy, which is originally recorded as I'm Just a Country Boy.
Yeah.
It's just a guy who, well, you tell me, who is this guy? Because it also is a kick in the gut.
Oh, that song for me, when Don Williams recorded that, and I'd listened to that song and I thought, oh, what a beautiful tune. I love the melody, and I love the story behind it, which is, you know, I may not be able to afford this, I may not get to have this, but I have these other wonderful qualities about me, you know, basically of how I see things through my eyes. And it was just such a beautiful story, you know, hearing it sung from a man, and then I turned it, you know, around to hear this woman is singing it to a man. There's something very beautiful about someone just freely giving all of that.
You just a country boy. Money, have you none? You've got silver in the stars. Gold.
You've picked a lot of good material for this collection you sing with Sting. How much of what you can do now is due to your success on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? For about a year, we had what we used to call the Alison Krauss segment. Where we just, you know, and here's Alison producing, here's Alison singing, here's a new film featuring Alison. You know, it just... I'm wondering, you know, is there a point where, you know, if you ever hear one of those songs again, you're going to scream, or, you know, how those projects just sort of really leapfrogged you?
If you have a connection to a song and it's not just kind of a, boy, not a frilly song or not a show song, if you have any emotional connection to it, like a true emotional connection to it, it's going to change through the years for you. Those tunes from Cold Mountain I thought were beautiful. And Down to the River to Pray, I mean, I knew that song. The original version of that song is called Down in the Valley to Pray. I mean, I grew up with that tune and knowing that. That's a beautiful traditional tune. Those don't tire for me. They change as I change.
Well, and you've got some of them on the new CD. Let's listen to You Will Be My Ain True Love.
My Ain True Love, yeah. It's supposed to be own, you know, like that's kind of an old way of saying it. That if I'm right, I think I might be.
I'm betting you are.
I might be right about it.
You Will Be My Own True Love, written by Sting, and here you are singing with him.
The field is cut and leads to red. The cannonballs fly around my head. The infirmary man may count me. But I've gone to find my true love. I've gone to find my true love.
So, Alison Krauss, how much is melancholy a factor in your music? I mean, you embrace it. You're not the only artist that does, you know, but...
Well, you know, I love... That feeling of loss in music and in life means there was something really huge and beautiful before that. And I think that that's why people are drawn to that feeling, is that there was something really magnificent that left, if the loss is so great.
Hmm. Boy, I could, you know, we could go through every track, but we can't. Is there one song that you'd like us to play?
Huh. Hmm. I like Molly Bawn. Pretty dark. I like it.
Okay, then. A little ditty about a woman who was shot because a man mistook her for a swan. Fiddler, singer, and band leader Alison Krauss's new CD is 100 Miles or More. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and there you can get the tour schedule for Alison Krauss and Union Station featuring Jerry Douglas. Alison, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston, and today we welcome listeners in Idaho, KBSU in Boise, KEZJ in Twin Falls, KBSK in McCall. That's just out your way in Albion. Love those meadowlarks in the morning out there. We'll have an Idaho postcard in the coming weeks. I'm Robin Young. Please join us then, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.